Okay, after Lubos's whirlwind tour yesterday, it was a bit hard to know what to do. So I was going to do a kind of a half a talk about quantum Monte Carlo and a half a talk on one particular application, which I think is interesting. But since then, several people have come to me and said, look, Lubos did lots of stuff, but we didn't really understand how he did it. And they asked me to give a kind of a tutorial, essentially. And so I didn't have one prepared, so for the last 6 or 8 hours I've been working very hard writing a tutorial on variational diffusion quantum Monte Carlo to try and cover what it can do, actually how you do it, what are the drawbacks, what are the advantages. So the slides are a bit dull, they're all in black and white, for example, but that's nothing to do with it. That's because of the computers here. That's my excuse anyway. So it's mostly going to be a tutorial on quantum Monte Carlo. If I have time, I may go and do a little bit about the application I wanted to talk about, but I don't think I will, to be honest. So anyone who wants to interrupt, you're welcome, of course. This is meant to be a tutorial. I'll do my best to explain. A few general waffly bits about the many electron problem. Basics of the variational Monte Carlo method, the simplest Monte Carlo method you can use for realistic solids. And then the diffusion Monte Carlo method, which is the one Lubos was mostly talking about yesterday. So I'll discuss all the tricky things like the sign problem and important sampling and all those things that get brushed under the carpet. Some of the problems about dealing with periodic systems, because that's when you've got long-range Coulomb interactions, that's hard. You can only actually study finite systems using Monte Carlo methods, so I'll talk about that. And then a little kind of summary of what you can do, what you can't do, and some conclusions. That'll probably be all I have time for. So I've never given a talk like this before, and I wouldn't risk it with most audiences, but people here do seem interested in how these methods work, so I thought it would be good to do, worthwhile trying anyway. So I've never even heard anyone give a talk like this. So this is my view about where Monte Carlo fits in. Is it a good computational method? Why do people compute? There's people who have a great theory, and they think it's a really cool theory, but there's one step they can't do the maths of. And then they put it on a computer. And there are other guys who, I think, like most of the electronic structure field, are frustrated experimentalists. And I think they wish they could do experiments. And they made a bad choice at the age of 21 or whenever they became theorists. And I think that's where I stand, really. So at least from this viewpoint, a good computational method, you can't get theories out of computation, but you can get good data. Okay. These Monte Carlo methods, they're limited, like most experimental methods, if you want, but they give good data. They're general and robust enough to give surprises. It's quite often easy to cook up some brilliant little clever little trick that solves one particular model in one particular limit, and you may get the answer and you may have to compute to do that, but you're not going to get anything general or robust enough to be useful. It's very simple, and that means that in some respect you can trust it. My experience of electronic structure theory is that the complicated methods die and the simple ones survive. Look at plane waves. Why are plane waves so successful? Because they're so simple. And it can be systematically improved, although that hasn't really been worked on yet much. But there's no doubt it can be. This slide is recycled from a totally different talk. To you guys, it's irrelevant mostly. But the many electron problem is actually, from a numerical analyst point of view, really rather easy. It's a pretty simple differential equation. We've got screening so that most things are short range. And so you might hope that you just need to solve a cluster, perhaps embedded in an effective medium. And the Pauli principle makes it easy as well, because it gives you all the idea about weakly interacting quasi-particles. The whole non-interacting electron picture is really based on the Pauli principle, isn't it? The only reason it's hard, in my view, as a numerical problem, is that it's in very high number of dimensions. It's a partial differential equation in many dimensions. If you solve it for Avogadro's number of electrons, anyway. The Pauli principle makes certain methods hard as well. It makes the Monte Carlo method hard, for example. So it's good and bad, the Pauli principle. But here's the bit I wanted to concentrate on. If we're going to try and do realistic studies, and that was the idea of this workshop, so we're going to do at least the valence chemistry as well as the valence, as not just an effective field theory that gets you everything right within a millivolt of the Fermi level, but we want to do the valence chemistry right, then the LDA accounts for typically 99% or better of the total energy, yeah? So you've got to get the chemistry right first if you're going to do this. Otherwise, you've got to separate energy scales and just look at some low-energy theory. And if you believe this and you're going to do this whole valence band structure, that means that precision matters, because if we want to get, you know, 0.1 EV accuracy, that's one part in a thousand. So your numerical methods have to be good. That's why, in my view, many of the rather crude basis set methods failed. I spent three happy but frustrating years working with tight binding models, and sometimes you get them to give the right answer and sometimes you don't, and it's really very frustrating. So if you're going to do this whole valence chemistry, I'm afraid precision matters. Most of the good methods are systematically improvable, at least in basis set format. So where do we stand? This is the last of the philosophy, don't worry, it gets more practical in a minute. We can do ground state properties of weakly interacting systems using density functional theory and quantum Monte Carlo of the type I'll be describing. That works quite well. The accuracy is perhaps not what you'd want, but it's not bad. You can do excitations of weakly interacting systems using GW. I don't know very much about it, but it seems to work pretty well. And time-dependent density functional theory, I hope somebody's going to talk about here. There are real experts on it here. So that's another thing I don't know very much about. The quantum Monte Carlo is in brackets because you can get some limited information out of it, as Lubos showed yesterday, and I'm going to be more precise about that later. Ground state properties of strongly interacting systems. Well, why did I put DFT there? Because if you calculate the phonon spectrum, say, it comes out right in DFT anyway. So most of the ground state energy is there, usually. No, there are counterexamples. So, it doesn't get what's going on within a volt of the Fermi level, right? But it does get a lot right. Quantum Monte Carlo, question mark, the kind I'm talking about, there's little real evidence yet. I don't see why it shouldn't be extendable, but there isn't much evidence. DMFT, well, it's early days. I'm not in a position to judge it. Excitations you can get on a 1 EV scale of strongly interacting systems. DMFT we've been seeing seems to be able to do that. These other things I just don't know about. That's why there are question marks. Quantum Monte Carlo is still in brackets because it still provides this limited information. Now, okay, let's take this 1 electron volt scale. I think that's about the temperature of the sun. So we're good on correlation effects in the sun. On ground state properties with quantum Monte Carlo, you can get down to 0.1 electron volt. That's maybe still several times room temperature. So it's still a good deal beyond what you want to study chemical reactions in biochemistry. So again, even for weakly correlated systems, we're not quite there yet. But it's still a long way to go. But if you really want to work on KT's temperature scale and T is 10 Kelvin, I think trying to do the whole valence problem is pretty stupid, and it's better to start with a field theory or something that describes the low energy excitations. So enough of that. Right. This is what I'm supposed to be talking about, the methods. Now, VMC of the kind we do is incredibly simple. You just guess a wave function. Instead of 10 to the 23 here, it goes up to maybe 1,000 or 2,000 electrons, typically. You evaluate, using that wave function, an integral over the 3n dimensional space of positions. So R is a vector that includes all the little electron vectors. And if there are 1,000 electrons, that's a 3,000 dimensional integral. With high dimensional integrals like that, there's only one way, and that's Monte Carlo integration. So you take this integral and just by algebra you rewrite it like that. And you say to yourself, aha, this is a probability density in the 3n dimensional space, which I can sample using the Metropolis algorithm, which I'm sure you all know. And this is like the score. In Monte Carlo, you're throwing darts into a target, and this is the score if you hit point R. And that's called the local energy. And you just evaluate that integral using Monte Carlo integration, and regardless of the dimension of the integral, you get 1 over square root of n convergence, where n is the number of sampling points, because that's how Monte Carlo integration works. And then you adjust the trial wave function to minimize the trial energy. In fact, you adjust it to minimize the variance of the trial energy in practice, but it's not much different. You can do either. There are a couple of good things about this, which I wanted to point out. One is that as your trial wave function gets better, this quantity, this local score function, becomes more and more uniform. It tends to the eigenvalue. And so that the variance drops, and there's essentially what we call a zero variance property, that if you knew the exact answer, you can calculate it with no work at all. Okay. Now, that seems useless, but it turns out to be extremely important in diffusion Monte Carlo. And this is a point Lubos made. Isn't guessing psi trial impossible? Well, I don't know, quite a lot of many body theory has been done that way. I don't think I need to emphasize that here. Perhaps you can say that all of it that's ever been done properly has been done that way. I don't know. So all the calculations Lubosch talked about yesterday, they were not variational calculations, but they were using a trial function, and that trial function was of this form. Okay. Now, there is nothing special about this form. I mean, it's not the only form you can use, and if you were interested in a Wigner crystal, for example, you wouldn't be using this form. You'd be using something different. But this is the form that's most often used in weakly correlated solids. And why do we use it? Why do we never do anything else? Because we haven't yet really run into serious limitations of it. There are very few examples we know about where it just doesn't work to the 0.1 EV energy scale. This is energy per atom. So you start with some kind of a determinant. I have a suppressed spin here, but you can put spin in, of course. These are one electron orbitals, which you get from somewhere. Usually we get them from LDA. We've tried getting them from Hartree-Fock, and Stephen Fahey has also tried optimizing them variationally. So I'll talk about that in a minute. So we just, yeah.
Excuse me. Why would you think of doing Hartree-Fock? Is there any advantage of doing Hartree-Fock, or is it just for comparison?
We just did it. Sorry?
It's not forbidden.
No, it's not forbidden, and we just did it. We did it because we wanted some idea of how crucial the nodal surface was. I think Walter Cohn mentioned this yesterday. He had the idea of trying to actually calculate it, which may be possible, I think. I was thinking about it last night.
Just wondering, because the chemists have the argument that if you do, for example, CI, you always have to start from Hartree-Fock.
Yeah.
And I don't see a reason
for that. No, there isn't. There is an argument here. You can base this form of the wave function on arguments based on the Bohm-Pines version of the RPA. And that says that these orbitals are something a bit like calculated from Hartree theory, actually. So density functional theory is not too far off. Okay.
Actually, there's a wiggling space on orbitals. One can say that maybe natural orbitals which diagonalize the one particle density matrix is the fastest converging one particle density set. But
yeah, I don't believe those arguments, and I'm also not aware that it's been proved better, and they're damn hard to calculate too. So we've tried a few things, and Stephen Fahey has actually tried variational optimization. And the story, at least in things like silicon and aluminium, is that it makes really not much difference. Really very little difference, surprisingly little difference.
Okay. There's a big difference in transition.
Yeah, I believe that. But I'm not trying to say this is a general thing.
I'd like to make a comment as somebody who started out a long time ago working on using variational methods for small systems. You are in a different world when you're talking about systems of many particles. When you're talking about small systems, then the important argument says, well, if you have a small error in the wave function, then the error in the energy, for example, is second order. For many bodies, systems, you never have a small error in the wave function.
Yeah.
The wave function has a vanishing with small overlap. Any trial function has a vanishing with small overlap with the true eigenfunctions. So you have to keep that in mind and not use this mode of thinking that people like myself who come from small systems tend to have. That's the merit of the wave function. Now the kind of surprising thing is that you can use a trial function whose overlap with the correct wave function might be 10 to the minus 6 and get the energy correct to 10%.
Yeah.
That's something to think about.
I don't think that's quite as surprising as it seems at first. I've been amazed by the accuracy of this crude approximation, but there is a sort of, as you get to a bigger and bigger system.
Exactly what I said.
Yeah. As you get to a bigger and bigger system, the density of many particle states rises exponentially. So within any tiny energy range, you have exponentially growing number of many particle states available. And it really, there's so much freedom around. Yeah, you have this enormous space, not even a countable space with the number of particles that the chances of getting a wave function with non-zero overlap of the ground state are zero anyway. Who cares? And but it may not matter if you're really interested in energies. It may matter for other things.
But these mays deserve thought.
Yes, they do. Well, they deserve thought, but another way to do it is to just try it and see, which is what we've been doing.
Okay, that's another way. But I recommend thought.
We have tried. I've spent years thinking about it. But anyway.
I don't think that overall bit is the crucial quality before
the world. No, it's not.
Because everything can be calculated from two particle density matrix, and what is important is the projection from the many body wave function to two particle density matrix.
You made that point yesterday, and I agree with that. Yeah.
Still deserves that.
Okay, so you start with a determinant that's got some exchange in, but no correlation at all. So you do the simplest thing you can think of, and you try and suppress the determinant, the wave function, whenever two electrons get close together. And this function may also depend on where the ions are and the potential, and it does in general. And if you do that crudely, you tend to just mess up the density. The LDA density you started with is not too far from the truth in most cases. And if you just do a crude job on this, it becomes crazy. So you put this in here. You can also regard this as just a modification of these single particle orbitals to take account of the correlation factor. There is a sort of a theory of this based on the RPA, as I said, but I'm not going to go into that now. You can, of course, use many determinants, and in, for example, localized open shell systems, you need to do that sometimes. U and chi are treated variationally always. Varying the orbitals in the determinant is much harder, but has been tried within a limited subspace by Stephen Fahey. And he's done a careful job on, again, simple materials, and he didn't manage to get much improvement in those materials. I think it would make much more be much more important than strongly correlated materials.
Yeah. How is the chi and the U chosen?
We've tried different ways. Originally we used, U itself, I should say that. I think I did say it down here.
Yeah.
One of the things
try an example.
Yeah, okay. So U typically looks like this.
Okay.
It's chosen so that at the origin, the wave function obeys the cusp condition. That means when two electrons get close together, you can ignore the potential energy is so large, you can ignore the rest of the system. It's just like a repulsive hydrogenic problem. You can work out the wave function, and you can adjust it to make that work. At large R, in principle, there's a theory based on the RPA that says that in metals, this goes like 1 over R. In practice, at large R, well, we don't have large R anyway, because we're in a finite simulation cell. And in practice, what we do out here doesn't make any difference to the energy. That's all I can say. So that's U, and we parameterize with all kinds of different ways of doing it. It doesn't matter very much. Yeah. Chi, we originally just represented in Fourier series. Now we represent in atom-centered functions. But it's a smooth, not very interesting object. It tends to enhance the density on the nuclei, where the electron density was originally high. Because the introduction of a U smears the electron density out a bit, and chi re-enhances it.
So the calculation doesn't depend on the choice of particles.
Well, I mean, these things are obtained by the variational procedure.
Okay.
Yeah, and as long as our representations are reasonably flexible and U obeys the cusp conditions, it doesn't matter all that much what we do. As far as
you do a variational Monte Carlo, how many parameters do you vary?
It depends who you are. We typically vary about 50. I don't know what Lugosz would say.
20, 30.
Yeah. So.
Few tens.
And is there a way to calculate the derivatives of the...
We don't have one, no. I think in principle you could, but we don't do that. We use a non-derivative minimization method.
I use a variable method, but it's...
In fact, I say this as if it's easy, but in fact this variance this minimization procedure is often tricky, and a lot of our time is spent playing around with this page. I'll come.
A question of location. It looks to me that the U of Rij depends only on the distance between I and J. Now, in general, it has also depends on Ri separately. Right?
We've played with that. The most important part, the cusp, is just an Rij thing. But we have tried using things that depend on Ri and Rj separately, and we have terms that depend on Ri and Rj and an angle between them and a nucleus and things like that. And they make small improvements, but they're relatively small.
What if there are a strongly inhomogeneous system?
We've tried it, and the improvements are relatively small.
I have two two different systems have different views, right?
Yes.
Okay, but if I put them together, I treat them as one system, I still have different views.
Well, no, you have very slightly different views. And honestly, we've tried, for example, we tried a whole range of strongly inhomogeneous electron gases with big wiggles on them. And we tried different views. And it really doesn't make as much difference as you would expect. I'm not lying to you here. The other thing to say is that when you do diffusion Monte Carlo, all this washes out anyway. It's important to have a good trial function to minimize the variance, but the energy that you get at the end, if you're only interested in the energy, doesn't depend on that. But yes, I agree with you. It's another thing that's worried me many times. And I still can't get over the fact that this works, really. Yeah.
I don't have a good feeling for the Chi function. That is an atom-centered function, or can you draw?
Okay, let's have a bunch of atoms here. Which sign did I have? I had it negative here, so I want Chi to be negative on the atoms. It will typically look something like that.
So you say Chi is negative on the atoms when you draw it positive?
Yeah, upside down. Okay, yeah. I said it right. So what happens is that minus Chi, it should have been like that, minus Chi is positive here.
Okay.
And so when there's an electron here, you get an exponential of a positive number. That enhances the wave function a bit.
Okay.
Okay? And that sort of counteracts the smearing induced by the introduction of the Jastrow U. But this all comes. This is not something we put in. Yeah, this is something that comes out in the minimization procedure. Yeah.
I think it was in the very beginning that Steve Louie and Steve Pye found out that if you put the cusp with an density down, when you start from, it's not completely, but quite screwed up. So you need just to multiply each row of the determinant by something to restore the originally good density function, charge density, which you were starting with. So it's just you're remultiplying each orbital or each row by some function.
Here's an example, in fact. This is germanium in a pseudo-potential picture, so there's low density on the atoms. There's a big high density in the bond. If you add just a Jastrow factor, it reduces. That's less strong. Mm-hmm. And when you put a Chi in and variationally optimize it, builds up again.
Why the new factor reduces the density?
It's quite easy to see, because when two electrons come together, U is repulsive, U is a...
Okay.
And so it just reduces the size of the wave function in those regions of this phase space.
U is repulsive, so it tends to decrease the density where the density is high.
Right. Okay.
So you need to restore it back because the density is rough.
In a way, I don't want to stress this wave function too much, because the point I was trying to make earlier is that that's not a crucial part of the method. That's what we use for weakly correlated systems. But I'm not proposing that we use that for F electron metals. other expectation values are just as simple in principle. Basically, any operator that you can write down, you can do this with. And you just sample a different thing. Instead of E local, you sample O local, which is this. If O is H, then you get this zero variance principle that this ratio becomes constant as psi trial tends to an eigenfunction. Otherwise, that isn't true. So it's more work to calculate expectation values of other operators, but it's doable work. It's not a limiting factor in anything we've done. Okay, so that's the simplest possible method. It's remarkably accurate. In the simple solids we've looked at, you get things like cohesive energies. That's a famous failing of LDA, so that's a little unfair. Much more accurately, we get them to within a few hundredths of an electron volt without any monkeying around, except, well, you have to add zero-point motion. There's no serious monkeying going on. But of course, you get garbage out if you put garbage in. And can you invent psi trial for interesting materials? Interesting in the context of this workshop means not silicon, I guess. So are there other methods? Well, the other one we use is DMC. This is much more interesting. Yes. Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
The garbage in, garbage out concept. I mean, is that a very severe restriction, or does it work only for communicative input, only for highly correlated systems? I mean, the question that I have is, I mean, would you say an effect of 100 is great for chemistry, for example?
Yeah.
They do have a transition state, and they can quickly get the right energy.
No, slowly you get the right energy.
example, these are not terribly highly correlated systems. They are weakly correlated.
Yeah.
Right? Would you say the LDA trial rate function would be garbage?
Hang on. Well, for all the weakly correlated systems we've looked at, and I think Lubosch would bear this out, this is all you need. Well, when I said that point, that few hundredths of an EV, I should have been talking about DMC. Sorry, VMC is a few tenths of an EV. I was forgetting which one I was talking about there. But when you do DMC with a trial function like this, you really do get to a few hundredths of an EV.
But a few tenths of an EV is LDA accuracy, right?
So well, it's better than LDA. LDA accuracy, I would say, is up to an EV, yeah, for things like transition energies. Yeah. GGA is better, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. So DMC is based on, like all these Monte Carlo methods that we're going to hear about in this workshop, I think, is based on the imaginary time Schrodinger equation. And, of course, what that means is if you start with some arbitrary trial state that has some component of the ground state, in the long time limit, that projection projects out the ground state because all these higher exponential states have faster decaying exponentials. That's all there is to it. It's incredibly easy. So let's just write down that imaginary time Schrodinger equation for one particle, because I'm going to start by talking about one particle because I don't want to get mixed up with the sine problem too soon. Yeah. So here's the Schrodinger equation, the imaginary time Schrodinger equation for one particle. It looks very like a diffusion equation. If I strike out this term, it's just a diffusion equation. And what's diffusing, the density that's diffusing around, the particles that are diffusing around make up a density, which is the wave function. So that's the first weird thing. The wave function is the density. Yeah? The other thing is, I'm assuming the Hamiltonian has time reversal symmetry here, so we can choose a real ground state wave function. Okay. There is a generalization, which I'm not going to go into for complex wave functions. So this wave function becomes the density. If I ignore this second term, it's just a diffusion equation. You could trivially simulate it. This second term is just like a radioactive growth or decay equation, except that the growth or decay rate is minus U of R, which depends on position. Okay, so it's incredibly easy to simulate. You distribute walkers. These are not particles. In this case, it doesn't make much difference. They're just points in space. But in the many particle system, it will make a difference. So I'm distinguishing here. These kind of abstract things, there are many of them, even though there's one electron here. So you make a population of these objects. And for each time step, you just move them by a Gaussian of variance delta tau. This diffusion propagator has variance delta tau, if you work it out, for a small time step. And once you've moved it, you calculate a weight, which is just the exponential growth or decay contribution to this small time step thing. And then you just replace your walker by this formula of copies. All this formula is, it's an integer whose expectation value is w. Okay, so it's either w, the number below w, or the number above w, chosen with the right weight such that its expectation value comes out to be w. So you're introducing a bit of extra noise there. And this is the uniform distribution on 0 to 1, in case anyone worries. It's not interesting. And you just iterate this, and then the limit as tau tends to infinity, the probability density would give you psi 0 of r. Now, that's okay, because this is a non-interacting one-particle system. The ground state is nodeless. It's always positive. So in principle, it could be represented as a density. It's a bit weird that it's psi that's a density here, but that's true. So that's incredibly easy and entirely useless algorithm. I've tried it, even for the hydrogen atom, and I could not converge the hydrogen atom with that algorithm. So what's the problem? I guess I should say that. The problem is that in the hydrogen atom, U has a 1 over R singularity, and you get wild fluctuations in these weights. You get wild fluctuations in the population, and you get, I haven't talked about how you estimate energies yet, but you also get wild fluctuations in the estimate of the energy. Now, the trick to get around this, which is one of the great strengths of this kind of Monte Carlo, and it's something that isn't really shared by the auxiliary field methods, and I think it's one of the great things that auxiliary field people ought to try and take away, is that you can get rid of these singularities and you can make this algorithm much, much more stable in a very easy way. And to motivate this, let's assume for the time being that the ground state wave function is known. Okay, it isn't, of course, but let's assume that. And instead of considering psi of R and T, let's consider this product. Now, whoever thought of this the first time, I don't know quite how they thought about it, but I think they probably thought about it because they know about Langevin and Fokker-Planck equations and various ways of transforming them from Hermitian to non-Hermitian form, and it's the same transformation that appears there. The equation of motion of this thing, you just, well, this doesn't depend on time, so it's just psi 0 d by dt of that. And with two steps of algebra, which may be not obvious but anyone can do, you get to here. Okay? Now what's the difference? The first thing here is that instead of u here, we have the ground state energy. So this term is a constant times f. So all that term amounts to is a uniform growth or decay of population. And we can get rid of it by choosing our zero of energy such that the population is constant. Okay, so that's trivial. Once we've done that, we're just left here with a Fokker-Planck equation. Okay, so what does that describe? It describes, I have a fluid whose velocity field is V of R, which is, happens to be given by this ratio. In that fluid I put some dye molecules, and the dye molecules both diffuse and drift along with the fluid, yeah? So that the current of dye molecules is just minus d grad rho, rho is f here, sorry, plus vf. Okay, and if I just combine that with div j plus d rho dt is 0, I get this equation. Okay, so it's a very simple thing to simulate. We just put our little dye molecules in, we allow them to move with the fluid, and we allow them to diffuse with diffusion constant a half at the same time. So it's equally easy to simulate. The wild population fluxions have gone away because without this term here, this conserves particle number, conserves the number of dye molecules. And V of R is well behaved because it's just grad psi over psi. And since we're after the ground state of a one particle system, psi is nodeless. So grad psi over psi is not going to diverge in any particularly nasty way. So this is now we've suddenly got a stable algorithm. And this kind of transformation is crucial. It makes it from a method that doesn't work into a method that does work. Now, I know various people who've tried using auxiliary field methods, Hubbard-Stratonovich-based methods, on real electron systems with real Coulomb interactions. And they have an analog of this gigantic fluctuation problem. And as far as I can tell, not really a great way of getting rid of it. There are probably people here who can tell me more about that. So in real systems with real Coulomb interactions, those methods are harder. So that's all there is to that important sampling business. That's in theory. In practice, we don't know psi 0, so we can't do that trick. So we just instead consider the product of a trial function, which is a guess, and psi. Now, the guess here is used purely to speed up the algorithm. I want to make a point that there's nothing it doesn't matter what we choose. It's just an acceleration mechanism. So it's not reliant on a trial function at this stage at all. You do the same manipulation, you get this, where instead of you get the same Fokker-Planck-like terms, and instead of a constant here, you get the local energy again. Okay? Now, isn't that nice? Because that hardly fluctuates. The better psi trial gets, the smaller the fluctuations in the local energy, because h psi is e psi, nearly. So, again, we have a stable algorithm. And again, V of R is well behaved because psi trial is bigger than 0. Again, the local energy is well behaved because psi trial is bigger than 0 and obeys the cusp condition so that this doesn't diverge nastily when two electrons get close to each other. And again, the population fluctuations vanish as you get a better and better trial function. So here's an algorithm that actually works. Okay, it's amazingly simple. It's a bit simplified, but you distribute some walkers around. For each time step in each walker, you move them by the drift along with the fluid and then a diffusion bit. You calculate this reweighting factor and you apply it. It's just the same algorithm as before, really, with a drift. And it makes all the difference, though. This one just works, the other one doesn't. In the long time limit now, the density you sample is the product of the trial function and the true ground state. Okay? Yeah, Peter.
Okay, maybe I missed the point. The echelon that you have, how is that chosen? Is it a subtle thing, or do you just adjust it when you get too many walkers?
This eta thing.
Yeah.
Oh no, this is completely irrelevant. This is just a random number chosen from the uniform distribution between 0 and 1. This is
control the number of walkers.
No, I haven't talked about that. I was trying to brush that under the carpet, but I'll talk about it now. So this just gets you either the integer below W or the integer above W. Yeah, W is a real number here. And it gets you it with the right ratio such that the average of those two integers, the expectation value, is W. Okay, so it just replaces your single walker by W on average, okay. But you want W to be an integer. You don't have to do this even.
Okay.
There is a problem here, of course, that the population, unless you're very lucky with your choice of zero of energy, the population will either exponentially diverge or exponentially die away. So you adjust your zero of energy as you go.
Okay.
And that's something I didn't want to get into. And that gives you one estimate of the ground state energy.
Okay.
Expectation values, this is a little fiddlier. So this is the last part about one electron DMC, but in fact everything generalizes. The ground state energy is an easy thing to evaluate because here is the ground state energy. The Hamiltonian is Hermitian, so I can operate to the left. That just pulls out E0 times what I had here, and that cancels the bottom. Okay? So the Hamiltonian is easy, and you can rewrite this ratio of integrals in this form. And this is the local energy, our old friend, and this is the thing you're sampling, normalized. So again, we just let the walkers move, and every time we've got a new position, we evaluate the local energy and average it. The only thing that's different now is the dynamics of the walkers. Okay, so it's a very easy thing to do. And again, we have this magical zero variance principle. As psi trial gets better, this thing fluctuates less and less. And that gains us factors of hundreds. Other expectation values are unfortunately more troublesome in this method, because if you try the same thing for some arbitrary operator O, you get this. So this is what you can evaluate. This is what you get. And that's not the expectation value of O in the ground state. And this is a problem. One thing you can do is by combining the DMC and VMC estimates with the same trial function, you get a kind of second order accurate approximation. That method, I don't know, it works sometimes, doesn't work other times. It's not very good. There are other methods which in principle allow you to calculate, to sample the exact size zero squared, but they become exponentially unstable in large systems. There's things called forward walking. So there's not really a great solution to this. In practice, that's why most of Lubosch's calculations were energies. Yeah. But I don't want to overemphasize this. You can at least get better than VMC results, and it is a useful thing, but it's somewhat limited there. Okay, so that's all one particle. N particles, how does it generalize? It's utterly trivial. You just write down your Hamiltonian, and then you write it like this, where big R again is all the electron coordinates in a row. And you say, aha, it's the same equation, just in a bigger space, bigger dimensional space. So instead of diffusing in 3D, these things are now diffusing in 3N dimensions. So you just do the same thing. You do the same important sampling transformation. Everything works out just the same, barring the signs for the moment. And in the limit, as tau goes to infinity, again, you sample this. So far, everything looks identical, and it really does work that way. And for boson systems, this is marvelous. It just gets you the exact ground state precisely with very little effort. So here's where it begins to get interesting. Let's go back to the case without important sampling, because it's easier to think about. It's just a transformation, so it doesn't matter which one you think about. The walker density, since it's just the density of diffusing objects we're interpreting all the time as our density of dimolecules, must be positive, yeah? And it's just, we can't interpret it otherwise. And if you just run this simple DMC algorithm, what do you get? You get the lowest energy state of the Hamiltonian, regardless of symmetry. There's no symmetry built in at all, okay? And that, unfortunately, is the boson ground state. So that's, in our context, the sign problem. It's quite interesting. Different Monte Carlo methods have sign problems which are apparently totally unrelated, as far as I can tell. They all relate. They all sort of have similarities, but they're not the same. They all have their own. So how do we impose anti-symmetry? That appears very simple. Yeah, different ways to think about it. But one way is that we use a little diffusion propagator that looks like this. Yeah, this is another way of writing my algorithm of diffuse and branch with a little time development operator like that. You could say the states we use here, the kets, are not symmetrized in any way. We could put anti-symmetrized kets here. And then you end up with a propagator that's determinantal, it's got determinantal bits. If we really want to go the whole hog, we could replace the interaction by auxiliary fields, and we're back to auxiliary field Monte Carlo. That's essentially the same thing. I don't like that method for, well, we don't use that method for the reasons that, first of all, as soon as this thing gets negative signs, we end up with a product of determinants and horrible sign problems, and we don't know what to do with them. And because I don't use that method, that's why I don't do it, really. That's the truth. Another way to start is to build the antisymmetry into the starting state. If I start with a state psi of 0, which is antisymmetric, this is time here, and I apply e to the minus ht to it, I clearly end up with an antisymmetric state, because this is a symmetric operator. So that ought to work. Now, in practice, it doesn't. And here's why. Let's imagine, I think it's the example Lubosch gave yesterday, but I'll give it again. Let's just try and get the antisymmetric solution of a particle in a box. Okay. What you can do is you can write this as... So we're starting with a state that looks a bit like this, but isn't right. So here's our starting state. Let's suppose it looks like this. So it's antisymmetric, but it's got the wrong shape somehow. Now we run the diffusion Monte Carlo. How do we do that? We can't really do it directly because it's got negative bits. And we want to represent a density. And the diffusing particles represent a density. So what you do is you write this as the difference. Your psi starting is a positive wave function minus a negative one, where the positive one is that blue bit, and the negative one is that blue bit. Okay? That's true. And now we have two separate problems. And since the Schrodinger equation is linear, we can solve them separately. We can solve the positive one and the negative one and just subtract the densities we get. And we run away with them. And what happens? Well, it's pretty obvious these things are diffusing around. So both of them in the long time limit will tend to that. Doesn't matter which we start with. And there is a small difference between the two, which decreases exponentially with time, which is the thing we want. And for that, this method is exponentially bad in large systems. It's hopeless. So it doesn't work. Okay. In small systems, things like this that are more sophisticated with cancellation of positive and negative walkers do work very well and can give you, in principle, exact answers. Okay. So here's how we get around it. The only way to do this problem, or the way we do it, is we just put a barrier there. Okay? And that barrier is impenetrable to electrons. In this diffusion picture, it amounts to an absorbing barrier. Any particle that hits it is absorbed. And then we solve the problems in this side and this side independently. Okay, now, first thing to say is that we don't actually know where the barriers are, because this is not really a 1D problem. We're doing a 1,000 electrons, so we have a 3,000 dimensional space, and inside that somewhere is a 2,999 dimensional nodal surface. We have no idea where it is. We define it with a trial function, the same trial function we were talking about earlier, and then we just scatter our walkers randomly, and wherever they land, we can evaluate the trial function and see whether we're in a positive bit or a negative bit. Yeah. And we can move them around, and every time we move one, we see whether the sign of the trial function changes, and that tells us whether it's gone out of the pocket it was in or not. Okay. So the other thing to say is that this one is a bit interesting. Suppose I got the nodal position wrong here. Suppose I put it here. What would happen? I have two pockets. One is a bit smaller than the other, and I get one wave function in another and another in the other one, different one with different energy. Now, the diffusion Monte Carlo method, the overall rate of population growth depends on the average energy, and it would be higher in this pocket, the big one, than in the small pocket. So in the end, all the walkers would end up in the big pocket, which seems a bit worrying, because you think, well, maybe if I get the nodal surface wrong in my many fermion system, they're all going to end up in one pocket, and it won't be antisymmetric anymore. But luckily, our trial function preserves antisymmetry, so it's invariant under permutation, so that doesn't hold. Okay, so that was probably misleading, and I shouldn't have talked about it, that bit. Let me just show you a bit of a nodal surface, because it's getting a bit hot in here. This is David Sepley's work. So this was 161 spin-up electrons in 2D, subject to periodic boundary conditions. Okay, so that gives you a 321-dimensional nodal surface. and this is a two-dimensional cut of that. And what he's done is he's frozen every electron that's marked by a circle here, and he's just followed this one as it moves around and seen what the sign, what happened to the sign. It's just for a simple trial function. I think it's a single determinant. And you can see that nodal surfaces are not obvious. That's the point here. Yeah? You might think they really matter, and that if you get them a bit wrong, which we certainly do, you get crazy answers. By magic, and perhaps Walter will tell us one day, because I can't, it doesn't seem to be that crucial. So there is a variational principle, and that's been proved, that tells you that the nodal surface, that the fixed node energy, the thing you calculate, is variational, and that the minimum value is exact. Otherwise, no details of the trial function matter. That's another point I want to make. Everything between these fixed nodes is calculated exactly. So the only thing that we're putting in is this nodal surface. That's an unconstrained approximation, and the only way you can adapt it is to adapt the nodal surface. And some small efforts are being made in that direction now. Okay, so when I said this is an improvable method, that's as much as I meant.
What if the wave function is complex?
There is a generalization of this called the fixed phase approximation due to a guy called Ortiz and Seppeli, which apparently works. I haven't tried it myself.
I really deal
with symmetry adaptive states. And externally applied magnetic fields is another important case. Okay. Back to practicalities, because it's been getting a bit waffly now. What's hard about solids? There are several things that are specifically hard about solids. For atoms and molecules, what I've said is what you do, and really there's not much more to it. I'll talk about the work required in a minute, but that's it. In solids, we can't do that because of one more thing I should say. There is a very bad scaling with atomic number, not with number of atoms, but with atomic number, okay, Z. The reason is that as Z increases, the range of energy and length scales increases dramatically. And you have to study the smallest length scales and the smallest energy scales, and it's just horrible. Big energy scales means very small time steps. And empirically, it's about the fifth or sixth power of Z, and that sticks you to the first row of the periodic table, which is not very interesting. So you have to use pseudo-potentials to get interesting results. There are...
Just one thing, I realize that neither Lucas nor you have very much emphasized the fact that you're making an approximation by making a finite time step. Maybe
I can talk about that if you... No, I wasn't going to talk about that. There is an approximation.
It's very simple, and it takes only a few seconds to explain, but maybe worth saying, because otherwise it would be no approximation whatsoever.
Yeah, I should have said that, but of course when you take a finite time step, you're approximating that propagator with a little trotter decomposition. There's an error there. The error in the time steps, delta, the error in the Green's function to delta t squared, and I think it gives... Well, t cubed, depends which Green's function you use. It can be t cubed. And the error in the energy you get out is one order of magnitude worse than that. So it's either delta t squared or delta t, depending on the Green's function you use. Luckily, these errors are really tiny, and you can study them by reducing delta t. So they're much smaller than the other errors in the problem. So that's not a problem.
Maybe the feel of how large is the time step.
The time step, we always do it in atomic units, and it's
10 to the minus 2.
Yeah, something like 10, a hundredth of an atomic unit.
Okay, but that's relevant here because, I mean, the fact is that when you have an enormous energy scale,
yes,
then you no longer can use reasonable time steps.
That's one of the contributions to this very big power here. The problem with pseudo-potentials is we don't have a proper many-electron version of a pseudo-potential. So we just have to take them from LDA or GGA or whatever. And that's a bit dodgy. There is also a small technical problem in DMC with using non-local pseudo-potentials. There's a workaround which works pretty well in most cases, but I'm not sure how well it would work in, for example, transition metals. It's okay, is it? Anyway, I think that's been one of the things that's held people back from really launching into strongly correlated applications.
So they have been provided, as you were explaining, you put into the core, into the valence of the core, usually
But then you have twelve electrons or something, and you run into the z to the 5 problem all over again.
Well, you need it because there is a chemistry there.
I think it's right. It makes it difficult to apply to those kind of materials, and that's a big drawback. But the approximations we're talking about here are quite small ones on the scale of some of the things that go into other methods. We have to use periodic boundary conditions as well, and this is another problem in solids. We can only do about 1,000 electrons. Why can we do so many? It's because we have all this important sampling and fixed node approximation on our side. And we apply periodic boundary conditions. That means that whenever electron goes out one side, it just comes back in the other. In band theory terms, that's a 1K point calculation for a supercell. It's very analogous to that. Okay, and you know that that introduces quite significant finite size errors, and we have to deal with those. So one thing we do, which some people won't like, but it works quite nicely, is to do an LDA calculation for the system we actually study with the 1K point, and then with good K point sampling, calculate the energy difference and add it on. Okay, we had a finite size correction calculated with an LDA. That works quite well for most of the error. There are other parts of the error that are due to the long range of the Coulomb interaction, which we've worked on very hard, and I don't want to talk about it, but all I can say is these are under control, but only to the 0.1 or 0.2 EV level, these kind of finite size errors. So not perhaps as accurate as you might like. The good news is for DMFT, because you're embedding in a proper model, you don't have the K-point sampling errors, and because you're replacing the Coulomb interaction by a U, somehow those have been, the Coulomb errors have gone as well. So I think that's good news for you guys. Otherwise, it really is quite local, the physics. So what can we do? Because this has all been theory. I wanted to get here sooner. I'm going to go fast now, but I suspect people will have more questions here. As I said, we can do total energies, at least pseudo-energies. We can do energy barriers and energy differences. To most people, and me included, this is rather a disappointing selection of things to be able to do, because it's exactly what density functional theory does so well. Yeah? We do it better by perhaps a factor of 10, and there is mileage in that, because density functional theory isn't quite good enough to do room temperature chemistry, is it? Or biochemistry, I think you'll agree with that, yeah? Even with the GGA. Yeah, it depends. You have to be very careful about what question you're asking, let's put it that way.
It's one question. Do you have 20 EV per atom? Is that the maximum error, or is it the mean square error?
I don't think we have enough data to tell you.
Constructed, is it?
It's just like this. But in most cases in real solids, you don't have a better answer. That's the first problem. Yeah, for ground state energies, there is no better thing. Experiments don't tell you better. So this is mostly extrapolated from what you know about small systems, where you can get better errors than that, and what we know about finite size effects. So it's hard to know, because you can't do anything better. That's all I'll say there. But where I say this 5% of the correlation energy is the typical fixed node error, that's, again, how do we know? We don't really. We only know for little molecules where there's a CI calculation to compare with. So we don't know for solids. Forces, in principle, we can calculate. They're just energy derivatives, but no way are we yet fast enough to do molecular dynamics with that. People are working on it, but I don't think it's very promising. Other static ground state expectation values. Basically, any operator you choose, you can evaluate. It's not that difficult. You don't have a variational principle anymore. You don't have a zero variance principle. You have this problem with the DMC estimator being not quite what you want. But all these things it's nevertheless practical and useful. So for example, you can calculate things here that you couldn't calculate in density functional theory, such as pair correlation functions, exchange correlation holes, all those kind of things, which I've studied. But no dynamics at the moment. There is a question, at least in solids, whether these calculations are better than DFT, whether the results you get are better than DFT. No doubt about energies, but how do we know with charge densities? How do we really know? The experiments, I don't think, are good enough to tell us. With things like Compton profiles, there have been clear improvements, momentum densities. It definitely works better, because you don't get it right in a mean field theory. So it's hard to tell in many cases, really how good you're doing, how well you're doing. So I'm sorry, I'm going to go on about 5 minutes later. If anyone's getting bored, just go and have lunch. Where's the effort? Because people have asked me this, several people. So what are we doing? We're just taking our walker, which is a really a just set of electronic positions. A position for every electron is a walker, and we move it around. As we do that, we have to recalculate the trial function, okay, and then the expectation values. So one of the things we have to do is to recalculate all the one electron orbitals in the determinant. Okay, so we have a big determinant full of one electron orbitals. So we have it, the determinant contains n squared entries, n orbitals across and n electrons down, you know, psi 1 of R1, psi 1 of R2, and so on. And so there's an n squared effort there, if you have an efficient representation of the orbitals. If you have an inefficient representation, such as plane wave expansion, there may be another factor of n just evaluating each orbital. I'm assuming here you can evaluate an orbital in order 1 time. You then, for technical reasons to do with evaluating the kinetic energy and updating other things, you also carry around the inverse of that big determinant. And updating the inverse of a matrix is an n cubed operation. Okay? So it's a you change all the elements and you have to update it. You have to calculate the Jastrow factor. That's an n squared operation because it's pairwise. And you have to evaluate the Coulomb energy. It's also n squared. All these things have question marks because in principle you can do better on every single one of them. Okay. The one electron orbitals, one thing you can do is determinants are invariant under unitary transformations. So you could make a unitary transformation to a basis of Wannier functions. And then all your orbitals, at least in an insulator, would be short-ranged. And your matrix would be almost all zeros. Your determinant would be almost all zeros. And this has been tried. And that gets rid of a factor of n here. That would also help with the Slater inverse problem. Inverting a sparse matrix is easier. The Jastrow factor, the long-range part of it doesn't affect the energy anyway, so you can cut it off, so we can get rid of an n there. Same for the Coulomb energy. There are fast methods like multipole methods which scale better than n squared. We haven't had to use them yet. I don't think I'll go through this argument. What's the actual scaling when you put these together if you assume the worst case, n cubed here, dominates? To get the total energy of the whole system, which is of size n, to an energy delta, requires work that scales like n to the 4. Okay, so if you want just the energy per electron to an amount delta, so that's dividing the total energy by n, it only scales like n squared. And both these may be beatable. Okay, now this is all pie in the sky because in practice it's completely irrelevant. We have not reached these scaling limits yet. Okay. And where is the work? Well, unfortunately, it's spread all over the place. There's no one clear bottleneck. I mean, in many cases, calculating the one electron orbitals is the hardest bit, but the other bits are not negligible. So it's not like there's just one thing we have to improve. But it's doable. I wanted to show Lubos's slide again. Now, I've explained enough to make more sense of it, to some people anyway. These are the kind of errors in energy differences that you might expect. These are the scalings, the ones I just talked about. And this is the time. This is the new part on this slide I wanted to show you. DMC is good enough to get chemical accuracy, I think, for molecules, but it really costs. And in fact, it's not even the computer time that's the limiting factor. It's all the fiddling around, optimizing wave functions and things like that that costs us the time, and doing the density functional calculations first. And it's a big job at the moment, and it's not yet efficient. Right, I'm going to very quickly now. Can you do excitations? Because this is a much... Yeah.
Maybe I'll stop you.
Yeah.
I would like to know how you define correlation energy. Why can't you give correlation energy for DFT?
Well, you could. Yeah. You as a percentage of correlation energy. Well, that's Lubos's slide. You better ask him. Correlation energy is the energy... is the... The true energy minus the Hartree-Fock energy is the correlation energy.
Right.
In density functional theory, you would do the density functional energy minus the Hartree-Fock energy. And that would be the correlation energy.
But that's very same quantity.
Right.
I mean, you don't get the total energies in DFT very often are off by huge amount.
Yeah. You're comparing methods that are so different. I think. It is determinant-based Hartree-Fock and density functional theory, that there are lots of, if you subtract total energies, there are lots of errors from the core.
Yes, I would say you get about 80-90% in GGAs of the correlation energy if you put that onto your graph.
I don't think you would, because it depends how you define it, but if you compare your GGA energy to a Hartree-Fock energy, you might be quite shocked, because they just, they won't agree nicely.
Practical version of DFT is not variational against the original Hamiltonian. Okay, so you get a number, but the number is off by a huge.
Yeah, it can cross over to be sure, right? Yeah. You can even have 10% sure.
Right. So
it doesn't make.
But the correlation energy is a well defined quantity. When you get the energy you get and subtract out your form. That's it.
Yeah.
You could compare all the methods you like.
And you could save some baby.
No, but you get a giant.
But the thing about DFT is it gives you nice energy differences for similar materials. But if you compare the total DFT energy of a lump of silicon with the total Hartree-Fock energy of a lump of silicon, you'll get a shock. They're not very closely agreeing. So that's why it's unfair to DFT to provide that comparison.
You take two Hartree-Focks, you make the difference. You make the difference again, then you define the correlation energy differential, then it might be more meaningful.
Yeah, you could do a difference in correlation energy. I don't have numbers for that, I'm afraid. Can you do anything about excitations? Because all this looks like a ground state method, and this is where there are interesting questions that I don't know the answer to. You can do band gaps, because they are ground state properties. Here's a band gap. It's the difference between an inverse photoemission experiment and a photoemission experiment. And that's been done, and that works, and there's no band gap problem a la density functional band gap problem. You can do dodgy things too, some of which Lubos showed you yesterday. We've done them too, where you take your trial wave function and you just, for example, add an extra electron to the determinant. Very hard to justify these things, by the way. And you subtract the two energies and you see what you get. And you can also make an excitation in the determinant, make a hole in an electron. All these things are kind of difficult to justify, but they work really quite well. So these are a few DFT values versus an empirical band structure, a measured band structure. That's for silicon, I think. Unfortunately, this is really uninteresting. Sorry? Was it? I don't remember. I think it was actually silicon, at least that's what it says. But they all look the same to me. Okay. Here's the point I want to make. In strongly correlated materials, this thing we can do is not very interesting, is it? If you don't have a sharp quasi-particle peak, what are you calculating when you calculate a band structure? One excited state. What's the interest in that? So unfortunately, I think this may be good for small molecules, but even in solids, it's kind of limited and hard to justify. Could we do this? This would be something that would be interesting to calculate, some kind of spectral function. Well, formally, I think there's no problem in it. And I was writing a review article once, not long ago, and I wrote this stuff in there because it's so obvious. And let me tell you what happened later. You can evaluate correlation functions like this. It's the trial function both sides, which is unfortunate, but you use the DMC to do this imaginary time propagation. And you can actually evaluate this. And this is the Laplace transform of something like this, which is pretty much what you want. Okay. So it's just like with all these imaginary time Monte Carlo methods, you can get correlation functions in imaginary time. And I wrote this down saying it can be done, and other people have written it down first. I wasn't the one to think of it. And David Seppeli read my draft review article and he said, no, it doesn't work. Okay. And the reason he said it doesn't work is that for some reason it's inconsistent with the fixed node approximation. It just doesn't play nicely with the fixed node approximation. When you apply this operator here, even when it's a zero particle operator, something like a density fluctuation, apparently it mucks up the nodes, and yet your diffusion is using the original nodes and it all goes wrong. However, this is hearsay. There has been no published study of this, and I'm not convinced one way or the other at the moment. Okay, so there's an interesting thing to study here. Why has nobody done it? Why are we so pathetic? Because there are only about four of us, and there's just a limit to what you can do. It's the truth. So Seppeli has tried here relaxing the fixed node approximation. Unfortunately, when you do that, You get an exponentially growing noise, inevitably, and then you have a Laplace transform of a function with an inverse Laplace transform of a function with exponentially growing noise. You might as well jump off a cliff. Strong correlations. That's all I have to say about that. I could justify this a bit more. There's nothing in the method that restricts it to weak correlations except the trial function. We don't even know where that trial function fails yet in any general way. The method itself, if you give us a better trial function, and why shouldn't you? I don't think it's impossible to invent a trial function for a Mott insulator. It should work. It has been applied in, for example, to study the Wigner crystallization of the electron gas. That's a strongly correlated system. Who knows whether it works? There's nothing better to compare with, and no 3D experiments yet either. So I think it can be generalized. The only thing you have to live with is this limitation of the number of things you can actually calculate. That's the drawback. Otherwise, it's a really good method. So it's practical. There's lots you can do. Very little has been done. It's not that difficult to program or understand. These trial functions work really well in most cases we've looked at. I can think of one or two examples where things went wrong. Cohesive energies are at least an order of magnitude more accurate than those obtained from LDA calculations, and so for chemists that's interesting, if they're prepared to suffer the pain of doing the calculation. I was going to talk about something totally different, which is all to do with exchange correlation holes. But there's lots of stuff still to do, so I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much for listening. Yeah?
Can you say a few words about quantum Monte Carlo calculation of the Sibylline field program?
Well, I've never used those methods, yeah? But I can tell you what I don't like about them.
Which method?
Hirsch-Phi. They're all based on the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation and auxiliary fields, and so you end up summing over lots of different auxiliary fields. But then your propagator is non-interacting, so it does a walk in determinant space if you want to think about that. I don't know. I know that people have tried these methods for realistic systems with true Coulomb interactions, and they have proved a disaster. The only one that appeared to me to be better was not in Hubbard models, I'm not talking about those kind of things, in these continuum systems. The only one that appeared to be better was the called constrained path method. It's a ground state method, unfortunately, so it's not useful for the DMFT guys. And that one does have a kind of important sampling, and it does have a kind of analog of the fixed node approximation. They're a bit different. I don't know the status of that. I've never tried these things. I'm no expert on them. I find it frustrating that we can do such large systems here so accurately, but for rather small few quantities, and they're not the quantities those guys want. Yeah. They can do piddly little systems, and they have a much worse thing, problems with sign problems, for example, as the system gets bigger, which we don't have at all because of the fixed node approximation. I know it's approximation. So there must be a place in the middle, I think, and I think perhaps it may be worth looking at generalizing these kind of continuum methods to see if there are ways to make them produce the things that they want. But I'm no expert on Monte Carlo for lattice-like problems. Yeah.
You didn't say anything about metals.
Can
you treat metals?
Yes, we can and we do.
Wasn't there a comment that Fermi surfaces are something of the future?
What you do when you have a finite system in theoretical boundary conditions, we talk with nature reality. No matter what you do, it's all the time essentially an equalizer, right? Because you can see and then you have a small gap disappears only in the limit of the infinite system, right?
We always have a finite system, so our metals are insulators with very small gaps. And the gap gets smaller as the simulation cell gets bigger. But all the methods I've talked about work for metals and give you the right total energies. If you want to calculate, say, a momentum density, that would be interesting in a metal. You can see what's happening at the Fermi level. Here you do run into problems, and perhaps that's what you're talking about, that because of the finite simulation cell, you only have a very coarse grid of K points at which you can calculate anything. So you can only kind of calculate a smeared out idea of it.
So if the Fermi surface is very complicated, well, you need a pretty large supernova, which is kind of obvious to sample all the pieces of it. So,
increase the boundary conditions now, would that be...
Well, actually, there are ideas out there which were tried for simple systems, like you can... Yeah. Since you are sampling already 3,000 images, it doesn't bother you to add another few hundred and actually sample for the K-point.
Yeah, but it's still not the right thing, it's just a generalization, a better wrong thing, I think.
Yeah, it would be a way to minimize the finite size error,
yeah.
To eliminate it, but it seems to be much more efficient than other things that we've tried before.
A much more interesting question is transport. How do we even know we've got a metal? How do we know? We can try and calculate band gaps, but we can't really expand the Brillouin zone, and anyway there's this problem that we always have a band gap, it just gets smaller in a metal. We can try. I've actually been looking at some old work of Walter Cohen's, where you define a metal by what happens when you twist the boundary conditions and by total energy. Yeah, that's a generalization of that.
Yeah. That driven has been tried at least for model systems.
Well, Richard is also trying it with model systems, but it's really quite limited what you can do in the way of transport, for example. Yes.
The answer been applied to Gleam 3.
To what, sorry?
Gleam 3.
Yes, I think so. Has, yeah, I mean, a long time ago. Though. Yeah. No, it has. More interesting there is you want to get finite temperature properties. And there's a thing called path integral Monte Carlo, which for bosons is great. It's kind of a generalization of this where you close the paths to get loops. And for fermions, I've tried it, and it's really problematic, and I wouldn't recommend it. Well, you have to. You're doing a simulation with a bunch of spaghetti. These spaghettis go around and in imaginary time, and then they hook up onto each other in loops. Yeah. And in order to build in the anti-symmetry in this kind of algorithm, you have to do permutations of how they hook up with each other. And our small experience of fermion systems was that there is a kind of terrible ergodicity problem. You just can't explore the space. It just doesn't work well. Sepoli has written whole review articles on it and has used it and has got results from it, but I had a very bad experience with it. It's possible I got something wrong. I put about a year into it.
There are some people here in the physics department who are pretty expert on this. Scalapino is the most senior person.
Yeah, that's on different kinds of systems, I think. But yeah.
Yeah, but it's the same method.
Well, they don't use diffusion, no. They don't use this. They use a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation always. So it leads to different problems, I think.
Well, there's a general problem that we can work well at high temperatures. We grow up at
yeah.
low temperatures.
Well, for bosons, they really work at all temperatures. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, that's intrinsic, and that's been the limitation.
Yeah.
If you're interested in the low temperature problem.
Yeah. No, that was my experience too.
Well, low temperatures is probably more efficient, and I talked about this to David actually, to build from zero temperature. Really, density metrics with excitations. It's a difficult part because there's a lot of stuff to put into a good density matrix, but it seems to be more promising than to actually start from the temperature of the sun or something.
I think that's what's evolved in the researches here. White has been propagating the density matrix. Walter Posto was kind of started from these Monte Carlo methods, then
have some lunch.